Thank you, Frank O'Connell. Ladies and gentlemen, Bill Simon, a director of the John Olin Foundation, the former Undersecretary of the Treasury, has a new book out. And in the foreword, it says, an unnamed correspondent passed this manuscript along to von Hayek, and Hayek read it and was motivated to write an introduction. The unnamed correspondent can be revealed tonight if Jack Anderson is present with Frank O'Connell, took the manuscript, Bill Simon's manuscript, over and had Hayek read it, and Hayek was so excited he couldn't believe a treasurer of the United States had the wisdom contained in that book. Now, I don't know whether that says something more about Simon than our normal Secretary of the Treasury, but that's a fact. If Jim Evans is in here, I told him, I already mentioned Jim Evans, about your letter is out here, but the paragraph he calls to my attention, he says, one out of approximately 3 million corporations in the United States, only 0.4% have employment levels of 500 or larger. Approximately 95% of the companies providing goods and services in the United States have fewer than 100 employees, and a third have fewer than 20 employees. He goes on to say that the people running these small businesses therefore need help and guidance in order to put their philanthropy to preserve the system, and they don't have large staffs. I want to introduce our next speaker, Ted Littlejohn from the Pfizer Corporation in New York, who doesn't have a large staff, who does administer a company funds, and I think in a very wise way, and we ask him on this panel to talk to us about what I call his smaller contingency fund allocations and how they can make a difference in funding freedom's right. Ted Littlejohn, please.
Thank you, John. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. When Don Lipsett called me originally about talking today, and I asked him if he'd write me a letter and tell me roughly what I was supposed to say and under what circumstances and so on, and he gave me some rather contradictory advice here. He first said that I suggest you discuss what you think the role of the business foundation should be in perhaps corporate contributions policies. And then he added, you might touch on things you feel should be done but which cannot be done due to management and public relations considerations. He then added, don't criticize the chairman of your board because it might, although it's off the record, you never know. And then he added, finally, it might be wise to gently temper your specific words at least somewhat less than you might express in a private conversation in a saloon at midnight. So it'll be clear to you that it's not quite clear to me just what role I'm supposed to fill. However, I will avoid criticizing the chairman of my board. I find that is a very good advice. I was interested to hear the description of the guidelines of the Olin Foundation, because I think it's evident that those are not the guidelines that the average corporate contributions committee follows. Recently, I had some experience in talking to people about the setting up, for the first time in this particular corporation, of a corporation's policy. And this group got together, and they huffed and they puffed, and they thought for a long time. And after 2 years, well, let me add first that they went out to some consultants, who shall be nameless, but who are the authors, I may say, of this vast volume, The Handbook of Corporate Social Responsibility. And on page 3, they say, we believe that corporate America is slowly molting the skin of maximum profits. Our society has shown it can operate highly profitable corporations, but it is now undertaking the next challenge of running a profitable corporation which maintains integrity, concern, and sensitivity for the human condition. And in this book, they collect all the details of all the programs of all the major corporations in the United States. And quite frankly, I'm surprised at the lowness of Irving Kristol's estimate of $1 billion, because the cost of these programs must be much more than that. And they were offering to this company these programs as the basis of the particular corporation's giving policy that they should adopt. Now, I'm not going to object to a lot of these programs. Many of them are very worthy. Many of them are very appropriate for certain corporations. But what I do object to is the tone of this introduction, which declares that if the corporation does this, then profits, corporate profits, will be acceptable in America, and the whole business environment will change. Now, we all know that what this represents is a very, this book, is a very organized presentation of a growing orthodoxy, if you will, of social responsibility. In other words, it represents the theory which is now orthodoxy, both in much of academia, in business schools, and in society, that the corporation is irresponsible, not unions, not government, particularly the corporation is irresponsible, and if it does these things, it will suddenly become responsible. You and I know, of course, that the record of public opinion about corporations shows that despite 15 or 20 years of this, there has been, despite the billion or $2 billion spent, there has been no noticeable impact on the acceptance of business in society. Moreover, if you look at some of the major critics of the of business in society, you will find that they have something quite different in mind than the social responsibility that these charming men and women of goodwill who write these things have in mind. Their focus is ideology. Some of you may have read this quite appalling book, I think, of George Lodge of the Harvard Business School on the New American Ideology, where he more or less suggests that we ought to throw out Locke and adopt Rousseau and have what he calls a communitarian society, an interesting combination of communism and authoritarianism. And he adds that the businessmen that are wise will be the leaders of this new change, this new moment of change. And one of their, incidentally, he says, one of their important roles will be to resist those who protest against the changing of the status quo. It really is quite a frightening book. And I could add others, of course. Mr. Galbraith, though he others call him a liberal, declares himself as a socialist. Or Barry Commoner, who welcomes the Marxism in articles in the New Yorker. So what I'm saying is we are dealing with an ideological struggle. And I'm afraid the corporation contributions committees of most corporations are inadequate to this struggle. I say that if you were a bunch of heads of corporation contributions committees and they heard the kinds of talks that were made today, I personally think that they would react against them and would be critical of them and wouldn't really understand what is being said, because they feel just as the proposal that was made by the consultants in this particular Corporation Contributions Committee I'm speaking of, just as a result of it, they made up a list of the division of the corporate contributions between health and education, civic and community welfare, and all these things. They divided American life up into all these little compartments with no recognition of the ideological struggle that I'm speaking of and which is implicit in what in the talks of today. So we have a very real problem, I think, with the ruling contributions philosophy in the corporations of America. And I frankly, and how do you change it when the very people who are administering these committees are unsympathetic or do not understand the kind of message that is implicit in the kinds of analyses and papers that you've heard today? Now, John asked me to say something about certain funds. I am rather proud to say that our chairman and president of our company do give me certain funds to administer, and I'm in a fortunate position. They're very modest, and I'm always afraid to tell people about them because the next day I always get five letters, and they don't amount to that much. But it does permit me to make a decision in a minute as to whether I will give a contribution on the behalf of the company. And we've done, I think, some interesting things. I will not list all those various organizations, some of whom are represented here, to whom we have made small contributions. But I would like, just as an evidence of the need to interact, which doesn't come easily with businessmen, with chief executive officers, with many people in corporations, interact with the intellectual world. There is an enormous gap, in my opinion, between the intellectual world and the businessman. I was out at the University of Chicago not so long ago because our chairman asked me to go out there and see to what we could give specifically within the University of Chicago. And I visited George Stigler, I visited the head of the economics department, I'm glad to say I visited Ronald Coase, who's here today. And I was told, of course they might have just said this to me to make me individually feel good, but it made me feel individually bad, that I was the first person from any corporation that had ever gone around to visit heads of various departments and hear about the programs so that we could make rifle-shot contributions to individual programs, individual professors, if you will, that we felt a kind of mutual interest in, and that they, as far as they were concerned, that was the first time that had happened to them. And so we try and do that. But let me just, in a couple of minutes, give you a few interesting examples which I think can show that with a little resourcefulness, a good deal can happen in interactions between not just the academic world, but serious writers. There's a great deal of interest now in anti-Keynesian, I don't like to use that word, works, but the problems that are coming up as a result of the the fact that Keynesianism no longer works. I called up Neil McCaffrey of Arlington House not so long ago and said, what would it cost to put back in print that old book of Henry Hazlitt's on critics of Keynesianism, where there were famous academic articles written at the time that Keynes wrote his book, and they were critical of Keynes. And he named a very modest figure. He said, goodness, that would be wonderful. If you could tell me right now, I can get it in our spring list. I said, I'm telling you right now. Well, he published it. It was out. And now I went to the Intercollegiate Studies Institute in Philadelphia, who represented here, and I said, look, you have this book program. We'd like to subsidize this book. Make it available to your large list of academics and students for $2. They said, we'd love to do that. Of course, we only expect to sell at most 500 books. They got the folder out. They called me first a few days after it was out and said, look, we've already got replies from the East Coast and we're out of the 500 books. And the ones from the West Coast haven't come in. They called me 3 days later and said, well, now, they asked if they could have another 500. I said, yes. They asked me, we're now out of that, and the other 500, and they're still coming in. So I said, well, you can have another 500. That was 1,500. So then they said they'd called up and said, well, they were up to now 2,000. Fortunately, the publisher had run out of books by then, and he's now reprinting. So that was the end of that. One example. Another example, we had a great interest in a certain subject. It was a serious subject, it was a concern. Well, I can tell you what it was. It's the whole question of food additives. And a girl came in to see me who has 2 degrees, advanced degrees from Yale and Harvard, and was establishing a consulting firm. And she said she was looking for a little seed money. And I said, well, look, I'll tell you what. Her name was Beth. I said, Beth, I'll make a proposal to you. I said, we've got a great number of files in this department on the subject of food additives. I said, you take them. I mean, you come in here and work, but they're all yours. And you do a paper for us, a background paper on this subject. And we'll pay you well. And we agreed on a quite substantial figure. And she did it. And it took her about 4 or 5 months. It was a scholarly piece she did. And she brought it in, and she laid it on my desk and said, there it is. And I said, well, fine. She says, well, what happens now? I said, I don't know. It's yours. She said, what do you mean? Well, I said, you write a lot of articles. You're on a radio program and so on. I said, it's yours. So she was so interested in this subject now, she went back to Boston. She got a Harvard professor to be her collaborator. And the next year, she was writing a book that was published called Panic in the Pantry, which became a major work. Meanwhile, she's written no less than 30 or 40 articles for women's magazines and the like. She now has a science radio program. And last week, she published a new book on the causes of cancer. And we started her in a whole new career. No censorship. We didn't review anything she did, anything at all. I'll give you one more example, and then I'm going to sit down. A colleague of mine, John Reed, who is a New Zealander and is director of corporate planning for our international division, came one day to me, and he said, you know, I had an old friend at Oxford, and I just had lunch with him, and he's teaching at Rochester. I hope Dr. Wallace is here, but... And he said, you know, he's discovered in this, since he came to the United States and is teaching, that as he looks out there and starts talking about certain drugs, he realizes that the students don't know about these drugs. They're not available in the United States. And he's doing a lot of research. And this was a subject that we were interested in and we've been following. And so we called Dr. Wardell and told him any way we could assist him with data, we would. And he was very grateful for this because we had lots of data like the dates of launching of drugs in various countries, or we could get them quickly. And he had always already well advanced in this work. And he was going to read his first two or three, it was his final paper. He was going to read at the International Conference in San Francisco. There were some FDA people there, and naturally they got quite excited when he was through because it was directed right at the delays involved in FDA. But a science writer for the Reader's Digest was there, and he went up to Dr. Wardell and he said, this sounds like a real good article for the Reader's Digest. Where can I get further information? And he referred him to us. And again, we had a file. Data and analysis is essential in this intellectual battle for business. And it's data and analysis within the business, too. And we, just as we had with Elizabeth Whalen, we had a file. And we gave Walter Ross a file, and he sat down in the office there, and he wrote an outline for the Reader's Digest, and they published his article, Why Britain Has the Drugs We Haven't. And that was printed in, of course, millions of copies. But meanwhile, just like Elizabeth Whalen, he'd got so interested in the issue that he'd begun to write a book. And a month ago, his book was published on this whole question of risk, the risk-benefit calculus, as it were, in human medicine. And he's been on many radio and programs and the like. What I'm trying to say is that it is a very great problem to relate the business to the academic world. And the only way you can do it is to get out there and work with these people. Offer them something, not censorship, but data and analysis, interest and help in the work that they're doing of mutual interest. And count and be assured that though you take a risk, that eventually that is going to get out into the media, as somebody referred to it today, and multiply and multiply. And business and businessmen have got to operate in that way and not think that they just give some general funds to a university or to all these other things, or even general funds to individuals or institutes. But you've got to maintain a friendly contact, continuing contact and interest in the work of academia, and you'll find that the academics are only, once they find that you're not trying to censor or interfere with their work, but to help them, they are delighted with the greater involvement and greater communication with businessmen.